bears go to sleep for the winter. He rehung the telephone, crossed to the sink, and filled it with hot water. He removed his shirt and washed. He had been sweating like a pig in spite of the cold, and a pig was exactly what he smelled like. There was some leftover meatloaf in the refrigerator. Lewis cut it into slabs, put them on a slice of Roman meal bread, and added two thick rounds of Bermuda onion. He contemplated this for a moment before dousing it with ketchup and slamming down another slice of bread. If Rachel and Ellie had been around, they would have wrinkled their noses in identical gestures of distaste. Yuck. Gross. Well, you missed it, ladies, Lewis thought with undeniable satisfaction and gobbled his sandwich. It tasted great. Confucius say, he who smell like pig, eat like wolf, he thought and smiled. He chased the sandwich with several long swallows of milk directly from the carton, another habit Rachel frowned on strenuously. And then he went upstairs, undressed, and got into bed without even washing his teeth. His aches and pains had faded to one low throb that was almost comforting. His watch was there where he had left it, and he looked at it. 9:10. It really was incredible. Lewis turned off the light, turned over on his side, and slept. He woke up sometime after 3 the next morning and shuffled to the bathroom. He was standing there urinating, blinking owlishly in the bright white fluorescent bathroom light, when the discrepancy suddenly showed up in his mind, and his eyes widened. It was as if two pieces of something which should have fitted together perfectly had instead thudded against one another and rebounded. Tonight, Judd had told him that his dog had died when he was 10, had died of infection after being scraped up in a snarl of rusty barbed wire. But on the late summer day, when all of them had walked up to the pet cemetery together, Judd had said his dog had died of old age and was buried there. He had even pointed out the marker, although the years had worn the inscription away. Lewis flushed the toilet, turned out the light, and went back to bed. Something else was wrong as well, and in a moment he had it. Judd had been born with the century, and that day at the pet cemetery he had told Lewis his dog had died during the first year of the Great War. That would have been when Judd was 14, if he had meant when the war actually started in Europe, when he was 17, if he had meant when America entered the war. But tonight he had said that Spot died when he, Judd, was 10. Well, he's an old man, and old men get confused in their memories, he thought uneasily. He said himself that he's noticed signs of increasing forgetfulness, groping for names and addresses that used to come to him easily, sometimes getting up in the morning and having no memory of the chores he planned to do just the night before. For a man of his age, he's getting off pretty goddamn light. Senility's probably too strong a word for it in Judd's case. Forgetfulness is actually better, more accurate. Nothing too surprising about a man forgetting when a dog died some 70 years ago, or the circumstances in which it died, for that matter. Forget it, Lewis. But he wasn't able to fall asleep again right away. For a long while he lay awake, too conscious of the empty house and the wind that whined around the eaves outside it. At some point he slept, without even being aware that he had gone over the edge. It must have been so, because as he slipped away, it seemed to him that he heard bare feet slowly climbing the stairs, and that he thought, "Let me alone, Pascal, let me alone. What's done is done, and what's dead is dead." And the steps faded away. And although a great many other inexplicable things happened as the year darkened, Lewis was never bothered by the specter of Victor Pascal again, either waking or dreaming. 23. He awoke at 9 the next morning. Bright sunshine streamed in the bedroom's east windows. The telephone was ringing. Lewis reached up and snared it. "Hello?" "Hi," Rachel said. "Did I wake you up?"
"Hope so."
"You woke me up, you bitch," he said, smiling. "Ooh, such nasty language, you bad old bear," she said. "I tried to call you last night. Were you over at Judd's?"
He hesitated for only the tiniest fraction of a moment.
"Yes," he said. "Had a few beers. Norma was up at some sort of Thanksgiving supper. I thought about giving you a ring, but, you know."
They chatted a while. Rachel updated him on her family, something he could have done without. although he took a small, mean satisfaction in the news that her father's bald spot seemed to be expanding at a faster rate. "You want to talk to Gage?" Rachel asked. Lewis grinned. "Yeah, I guess so," he said. "Don't let him hang up the phone like he did the other time." Much rattling at the other end, dimly he heard Rachel cajoling the kid to say, "Hi, Daddy." At last Gage said,
"Hi, Daddy."
"Hi, Gage," Lewis said cheerfully. "How you doing? How's your life? Did you pull over your granddad's pipe rack again? I certainly hope so. Maybe this time you can trash his stamp collection as well." Gage babbled on happily for 30 seconds or so, interspersing his gobbles and grunts with a few recognizable words from his growing vocabulary. "Mommy, Ellie, Granda, Grandma, Ka," Carr pronounced in the best Yankee tradition, Lewis was amused to note, "Twuck," and
"Shit."
At last Rachel pried the phone away from him, to Gage's wail of indignation and Lewis's measured relief. He loved his son and missed him like mad, but holding a conversation with a not-quite-two-year-old was like trying to play cribbage with a lunatic. The cards kept going everywhere, and sometimes you found yourself pegging backward. "So how's everything there?" Rachel asked. "Okay," Lewis said, with no hesitation at all this time. But he was aware he had crossed a line. Back when Rachel had asked him if he had gone over to Judd's last night and he had told her he had. In his mind, he suddenly heard Judd Crandall saying, "The soil of a man's heart is stonier, Lewis. A man grows what he can, and he tends it." "Well, a little dull, if you want to know the God's honest. Miss you. You actually mean to tell me you're not enjoying your vacation from this sideshow?" "Oh, I like the quiet," he admitted, "sure. But it gets strange after the first 24 hours or so."
"Can I talk to Daddy?"
It was Ellie in the background.
"Lewis, Ellie's here."
"Okay, put her on." He talked to Ellie for almost 5 minutes. She prattled on about the doll Grandma had gotten her, about the trip she and Granda had taken to the stockyards.
"Boy, do they stink, Daddy," Ellie said,
and Lewis thought, "Your Granda's no rose either, sweetie." About how she had helped make bread, and about how Gage had gotten away from Rachel while she was changing him. Gage had run down the hallway and pooped right in the doorway leading into Granda's study.
"Attaboy, Gage," Lewis thought, a big grin spreading over his face.
He actually thought he was going to get away, at least for this morning, and was getting ready to ask Ellie for her mother again so he could say goodbye to her when Ellie asked,
"How's church, Daddy? Does he miss me?"
The grin faded from Lewis's mouth, but he answered readily, and with the perfect note of offhanded casualness. "He's fine, I guess. I gave him the leftover beef stew last night and then put him out. Haven't seen him this morning, but I just woke up."
"Oh, boy, you would have made a great murderer, cool as a cucumber.
Dr. Creed, when did you last see the deceased?"
"Oh, he came in for supper, had a plate of beef stew, in fact. I haven't seen him since then."
"Well, give him a kiss for me."
"Yuck, kiss your own cat," Lewis said, and Ellie giggled.
"You want to talk to Mommy again, Daddy?"
"Sure, put her on." Then it was over. He talked to Rachel for another couple of minutes. The subject of church was not touched upon. He and his wife exchanged love yous, and Lewis hung up.
"That's that," he said to the empty, sunny room, and maybe the worst thing about it was that he didn't feel bad, didn't feel guilty at all.
24. Steve Masterton called around 9:30 and asked if Lewis would like to come up to the university and play some racquetball. The place was deserted, he said gleefully, and they could play the whole goddamn day if they wanted to. Lewis could understand the glee. When the university was in session, the waiting list for a racquetball court was sometimes 2 days long. But he declined all the same, telling Steve he wanted to work on an article he was writing for the Magazine of College Medicine.
"You sure?" Steve asked. "All work and no play make Jack a dull boy, you know."
"Check me later," Lewis said. "Maybe I'll be up for it." Steve said he would and hung up. Lewis had only told a half lie this time. He did plan to work on his article, which concerned itself with treating contagious ailments such as chickenpox and mononucleosis in the infirmary environment. But the main reason he had turned down Steve's offer was that he was a mass of aches and pains. He had discovered this as soon as he finished talking to Rachel and went into the bathroom to brush his teeth. His back muscles creaked and groaned. His shoulders were sore from lugging the cat in that damn garbage bag, and the hamstrings and back of his knees felt like guitar strings tuned 3 octaves past their normal pitch. Christ, he thought, and you had the stupid idea you were in some kind of shape. He would have looked cute trying to play racquetball with Steve, lumbering around like an arthritic old man. And speaking of old men, he hadn't made that hike into the woods the night before by himself. He had gone with a guy who was closing in on 85. He wondered if Judd was hurting as badly as he was this morning. He spent an hour and a half working on his article, but it did not march very well. The emptiness and the silence began to get on his nerves, and at last he stacked his yellow legal pads and the off-prints he had ordered from Johns Hopkins on the shelf above his typewriter, put on his parka, and crossed the road. Judd and Norma weren't there, but there was an envelope tacked to the porch with his name written across the front of it. He took it down and opened the flap with his thumb.
Lewis, the good wife and me are off to Bucksport to do some shopping and to look at a Welsh dresser at the Emporium Galorium that Norma's had her eye on for about 100 years, it seems like. Probably we'll have a spot of lunch at McLeod's while we're there, and come back in the late afternoon. Come on over for a beer or two tonight if you want. Your family is your family. I don't want to be no Budinsky. But if Ellie were my daughter, I wouldn't rush to tell her that that cat got killed on the highway. Why not let her enjoy her holiday? By the way, Lewis, I wouldn't talk about what we did last night either. Not around North Ludlow. There are other people who know about that old Micmac burying ground, and there are other people in town who have buried their animals there. You might say it's another part of the pet cemetery. Believe it or not, there is even a bull buried up there. Old Zack McGovern, who used to live out on Stackpole Rudd, buried his prize bull, Hanratty, in the Micmac burying ground back in 1967 or 68. Ha ha! He told me that he and his 2 boys had taken that bull out there, and I laughed until I thought I would rupture myself. But people around here don't like to talk about it, and they don't like people they consider to be outsiders to know about it. Not because some of these old superstitions go back 300 years or more, although they do, but because they sort of believe in those superstitions, and they think any outsider who knows that they do must be laughing at them. Does that make any sense? I suspect it doesn't, but nevertheless, that's how it is. So just do me a favor and keep shut on the subject, will you? We will talk more about this, probably tonight, and by then you will understand more. But in the meantime, I want to tell you that you did yourself proud. I knew you would. Judd. P.S. Norma doesn't know what this note says. I told her something different. And I would just as soon keep it that way if it's all the same to you. I've told Norma more than one lie in the 58 years we've been married, and I'd guess that most men tell their wives a smart of lies, but, you know, most of them could stand before God and confess them without dropping their eyes from his. Well, drop over tonight, and we'll do a little boozing. J.
Lewis stood on the top step leading to Judd and Norma's porch, now bare, its comfortable rattan furniture stored to wait for another spring, frowning over this note. Don't tell Ellie the cat had been killed. He hadn't. Other animals buried there? Superstitions going back 300 years?
And by then you will understand more.
He touched this line lightly with his finger, and for the first time allowed his mind to deliberately turn back to what they had done the night before. It was blurred in his memory. It had the melting, cotton-candy texture of dreams, or of waking actions performed under a light haze of drugs. He could recall climbing the deadfall, and the odd, brighter quality of light in the bog, that and the way it had felt 10 or 20 degrees warmer there. But all of it was like the conversation you had with the anesthetist
just before he or she put you out like a light.
And I'd guess most men tell their wives a smart of lies.
Wives and daughters as well, Lewis thought. But it was eerie, the way Judd seemed almost to know what had transpired this morning, both on the telephone and in his own head. Slowly he refolded the note, which had been written on a sheet of lined paper like that in a schoolboy's blue horse tablet, and put it back in the envelope. He put the envelope into his hip pocket and crossed the road again.
25. It was around 1 o'clock that afternoon when church came back like the cat in the nursery rhyme. Lewis was in the garage where he had been working off and on for the last 6 weeks on a fairly ambitious set of shelves. He wanted to put all of the dangerous garage stuff, such as bottles of windshield wiper fluid, antifreeze, and sharp tools, on the shelves, where they would be out of Gage's reach. He was hammering in a nail when Church strolled in, his tail high. Lewis did not drop the hammer or even slam his thumb. His heart jogged in his chest but did not leap. A hot wire seemed to glow momentarily in his stomach and then cool immediately, like the filament of a light bulb that glows overbrightly for a moment and then burns out. It was as if, he told himself later, he had spent that entire sunny post-Thanksgiving Friday morning waiting for church to come back. As if he had known in some deeper, more primitive part of his mind what their night hike up to the Mi'kmaq burying ground had meant all along. He put the hammer down carefully, spat the nails he had been holding in his mouth back into his palm, and then dumped them into the pockets of his workman's apron. He went to church and picked the cat up. Live weight, he thought with a kind of sick excitement. He weighs what he did before he was hit. This is live weight. He was heavier in the bag. He was heavier when he was dead. His heart took a bigger jog this time, almost a leap, and for a moment the garage seemed to swim in front of his eyes. Church laid his ears back and allowed himself to be held. Lewis carried him out into the sunlight and sat down on the back steps. The cat tried to get down then, but Lewis stroked him and held him on his lap. His heart seemed to be taking regular jogs now. He probed gently into the heavy ruff of fur at Church's neck, remembering the sick, boneless way Church's head had swiveled on his broken neck the night before. He felt nothing now but good muscle and tendon. He held Church up and looked at the cat's muzzle closely. What he saw there caused him to drop the cat onto the grass quickly and to cover his face with one hand, his eyes shut. The whole world was swimming now, and his head was full of a tottery, sick vertigo. It was the sort of feeling he could remember from the bitter end of long drunks just before the puking started. There was dried blood caked on Church's muzzle, and caught in his long whiskers were two tiny shreds of green plastic. Bits of hefty bag.
We will talk more about this, and by then you will understand more.
Oh, Christ, he understood more than he wanted to right now.
Give me a chance, Lewis thought, and I'll understand myself right into the nearest mental asylum. He let Church into the house, got his blue dish, and opened a tuna and liver cat dinner. As he spooned the gray-brown mess out of the can, Church purred unevenly and rubbed back and forth along Lewis's ankles. The feel of the cat caused Lewis to break out in goose flesh, and he had to clench his teeth grimly to keep from kicking him away. His furry sides felt somehow too slick, too thick. In a word, loathsome. Lewis found he didn't care if he never touched Church again. When he bent and put the dish on the floor, Church streaked past him to get it, and Lewis could have sworn he smelled sour earth, as if it had been ground into the cat's fur. He stood back, watching the cat eat. He could hear him smacking. Had Church smacked over his food that way before? Perhaps he had, and Lewis had just never noticed. Either way, it was a disgusting sound.
Gross, Ellie would have said.
Abruptly, Lewis turned and went upstairs. He started at a walk, but by the time he got to the upper hallway, he was almost running. He undressed, tossing all of his clothes in the laundry hamper, although he had put them on fresh from the underwear out that morning. He drew himself a hot bath, as hot as he could take it, and plopped in. The steam rose around him, and he could feel the hot water working on his muscles, loosening them. The bath was also working on his head, loosening that. By the time the water had begun to cool, he was feeling dozy and pretty much all right again.
The cat came back, just like the cat in the nursery rhyme, all right? So what? Big deal.
It had been all a mistake. Hadn't he thought to himself yesterday evening that Church looked remarkably whole and unmarked for an animal that had been struck by a car?
Think of all the woodchucks and cats and dogs you've seen strewn all over the highway, he thought. Their bodies burst, their guts everywhere. Technicolor, as Loudon Wainwright says on that record about the dead skunk.
It was obvious now. Church had been struck hard and stunned. The cat he had carried up to Judd's old Micmac burying ground had been unconscious, not dead. Didn't they say cats had 9 lives? Thank God he hadn't said anything to Ellie. She wouldn't ever have to know how close Church had come. The blood on his mouth and ruff, the way his neck turned. But he was a doctor, not a vet. He had made a misdiagnosis, that was all. It had hardly been under the best circumstances for close examination, squatting on Judd's lawn in 20-degree temperatures, the light almost gone from the sky. And he had been wearing gloves. That could have... A bloated, misshapen shadow rose on the tiled bathroom wall, like the head of a small dragon or of some monstrous snake. Something touched his bare shoulder lightly and skidded. Lewis jerked upward galvanically, splashing water out of the tub and soaking the bath mat. He turned, cringing back at the same time, and stared into the muddy yellow-green eyes of his daughter's cat, who was perched on the lowered seat of the toilet. Church was swaying slowly back and forth, as if drunk. Lewis watched, his body crawling with revulsion, a scream barely held back in his mouth by his clamped teeth. Church had never looked like this, had never swayed like a snake trying to hypnotize its prey, not before he was fixed and not afterward. For the first time and last time, he played with the idea that this was a different cat, one that just looked like Ellie's, a cat that had just wandered into his garage while he was putting up those shelves, and that the real Church was still buried under that cairn on the bluff in the woods. But the markings were the same. And the one ragged ear, and the paw that had that funny chewed look. Ellie had slammed that paw in the back door of their little suburban house when Church was little more than a kitten. It was Church, all right.
Get out of here, Lewis whispered hoarsely at him.
Church stared at him a moment longer. God, his eyes were different. Somehow they were different. And then leapt down from the toilet seat. He landed with none of the uncanny grace cats usually display. He staggered awkwardly, haunches thudding against the tub. And then he was gone.
It, Lewis thought. Not he. It. Remember, it's been spayed.
He got out of the tub and dried off quickly, jerkily. He was shaved and mostly dressed when the phone rang, shrill in the empty house. When it sounded, Lewis whirled, eyes wide, hands going up. He lowered them slowly. His heart was racing. His muscles felt full of adrenaline. It was Steve Masterton, checking back about racquetball, and Lewis agreed to meet him at the Memorial Gym in an hour. He could not really afford the time, and racquetball was the last thing in the world he felt like right now, but he had to get out. He wanted to get away from the cat. That weird cat which had no business being there at all. He hurried, tucking in his shirt quickly, stuffing a pair of shorts, a t-shirt, and a towel into his zipper bag, and trotting down the stairs. Church was lying on the fourth riser from the bottom. Lewis tripped over the cat and almost fell. He managed to grab the banister and barely save himself from what could have been a nasty fall. He stood at the bottom of the stairs, breathing in snatches, his heart racing, the adrenaline whipping unpleasantly through his body. Church stood up, stretched, and seemed to grin at him. Lewis left. He should have put the cat out, he knew that, but he didn't. At that particular moment, he didn't think he could bring himself to touch it.
26. Judd lit a cigarette with a wooden kitchen match, shook it out, and tossed the stub into a tin ashtray with a barely readable Jim Beam advertisement painted on its bottom.
Yeah, it was Stanley Bouchard who told me about the place. He paused, thinking.
Barely touched glasses of beer stood before them on the checked oilcloth that covered the kitchen table. Behind them, the barrel of range oil clamped to the wall gurgled three times, deliberately, and was still. Lewis had caught a pickup supper with Steve. Submarine sandwiches and the mostly deserted bear's den. He had found out early that if you asked for a hoagie or a grinder or a gyro in Maine, they didn't know what you were talking about. Ask for a sub or a Whopper burger and you are in business. With some food in him, Lewis began to feel better about Church's return, felt that he had things more in perspective. But he was still not anxious to return to his dark, empty house, where the cat could be, let's face it, gang, anywhere at all. Norma sat with them for quite a while, watching TV and working on a sampler that showed the sun going down behind a small county meeting house. The cross on the roof tree was silhouetted black against the setting sun. Something to sell, she said, at the church sale the week before Christmas. Always a big event. Her fingers moved well, pushing the needle through the cloth, pulling it up through the steel circle. Her arthritis was barely noticeable tonight. Lewis supposed it might be the weather, which had been cold but very dry. She had recovered nicely from her heart attack, and on that evening, less than 10 weeks before a cerebral accident would kill her, he thought she looked less haggard and actually younger. On that evening, he could see the girl she had been. At 9:45, she said good night, and now he sat here with Judd, who had ceased speaking and seemed only to be following his cigarette smoke up and up, like a kid watching a barber pole to see where the stripes go. Stanny B., Lewis prompted gently. Judd blinked and seemed to come back to himself.
Oh, yeah, he said. Everyone in Ludlow, round Bucksport and Prospect and Arrington too, I guess, just called him Stanny B. That year my dog Spot died, 1910, I mean, the first time he died, Stanny was already an old man, and more than a little crazy. There was others around these parts that knew the Mi'kmaq burying ground was there, but it was Stanny B. I heard it from, and he knew about it from his father before him. A whole family of proper Canucks they were.
Judd laughed and sipped his beer.
I can still hear him talking in that broken English of his. He found me sitting behind the livery stable that used to stand on Route 15, except it was just the Bangor-Bucksport road back then, right about where the Orinco plant is now. Spot wasn't dead, but he was going, and my dad sent me away to check on some chicken feed, which old Yorkie sold back then. We didn't need chicken feed any more than a cow needs a blackboard, and I knew well enough why he sent me down there.
He was going to kill the dog?
He knew how tenderly I felt about Spot, so he sent me away while he did it. I saw about the chicken feed, and while old Yorkie set it out for me, I went around back and sat down on the old grindstone that used to be there, and just bawled.
Judd shook his head slowly and gently, still smiling a little.
And along comes old Stanny B., he said. Half the people in town thought he was soft, and the other half thought he might be dangerous. His grandfather was a big fur trapper and trader in the early 1800s. Stanley's granda would go all the way from the Maritimes to Bangor and Derry, sometimes as far south as Skowhegan to buy pelts, or so I've heard. He drove a big wagon covered with rawhide strips like something out of a medicine show. He had crosses all over it, for he was a proper Christian and would preach on the resurrection when he was drunk enough. This is what Stanny said. He loved to talk about his granda. But he had pagan Indian signs all over it as well, because he believed that all Indians, no matter what the tribe, belonged to one big tribe. that lost one of Israel the Bible talks about. He said he believed all Indians were hellbound, but that their magic worked because they were Christians all the same in some queer, damned way. Stanny's granda bought from the Micmacs and did a good business with them long after most of the other trappers and traders had given up or gone west, because he traded with them at a fair price, and because, Stanny said, he knew the whole Bible by heart, and the Micmacs liked to hear him speak the words the Black Robes had spoken to them in the years before the buckskin men and woodsmen came.
He fell silent. Lewis waited.
The Micmacs told Stanny B's granda about the burying ground, which they didn't use anymore, because the Wendigo had soured the ground, and about Little God Swamp and the steps and all the rest. The Wendigo story, now, that was something you could hear in those days all over the North Country. It was a story they had to have, the same way I guess we have to have some of our Christian stories. Norma would damn me for a profaner if she heard me say that, but Lewis, it's true. Sometimes, if the winter was long and hard and the food was short, there were North Country Indians who would finally get down to the bad place, where it was starve or do something else.
Cannibalism? Judge shrugged.
Maybe. Maybe they'd pick out someone who was old and used up, and then there would be a stew for a while. And the story they worked out would be that the Wendigo had walked through their village or encampment while they were sleeping and touched them. And the Wendigo was supposed to give those it touched a taste for the flesh of their own kind.
Lewis nodded, saying the devil made them do it.
Sure. My own guess is that the Micmacs around here had to do it at some point, and that they buried the bones of whoever they ate, one or two, maybe even 10 or a dozen, up there in their burying ground.
And then decided the ground had gone sour, Lewis muttered.
So here's Stanny B come out in back of the livery to get his jug, I guess, Judd said. Already half-crocked, he was. His grandfather was worth maybe $1 million when he died, or so people said, and Stanny B was nothing but the local ragman. He asked me what was wrong, and I told him. He saw I'd been bawling, and he told me there was a way it could be fixed up, if I was brave and sure I wanted it fixed up. I said I'd give anything to have Spot well again, and I asked him if he knew a vet that could do it. Don't know, no vet me, Stanny said, but I know how to fix your dog, boy. You go home now and tell your dad to put that dog in a grain sack, but you ain't gonna bury him, no. You're gonna drag him up to the pet cemetery, and you're gonna put him in the shade by the big deadfall. Then you're gonna come back and say it's done. I asked him what good that would do, and Stanny told me to stay awake that night and come out when he threw a stone against my window. And it be midnight, boy, so if you forget Stanny B and go to sleep, Stanny B gonna forget you, and it's goodbye, dog, let him go straight to hell.
Judd looked at Lewis and lit another cigarette.
It went just the way Stanny set it up. When I got back, my dad said he'd put a bullet in Spot's head to spare him any more suffering. I didn't even have to say anything about the pet cemetery. My dad asked me if I didn't think Spot would want me to bury him up there, and I said I guessed he would. So off I went, dragging my dog in a grain sack. My dad asked me if I wanted help, and I said no, because I remembered what Stanny B said. I laid awake that night, forever seemed like. You know how time is for kids. It would seem to me I must have stayed awake right around until morning, and then the clock would only chime 10 or 11. A couple of times I almost nodded off, but each time I snapped wide awake again. It was almost as if someone had shaken me and said, "Wake up, Judd, wake up," like something wanted to make sure I stayed awake.
Lewis raised his eyebrows at that, and Judd shrugged.
When the clock in the downstairs hall chimed 12, I got right up and sat there, dressed on my bed with the moon shining in the window. Next I know, the clock is chiming the half hour, then 1 o'clock, and still no Stanny B. He's forgot all about me, that dumb Frenchman, I think to myself, and I'm getting ready to take my clothes off again when these two pebbles whap off the window, damn near hard enough to break the glass. One of them did put a crack in a pane, but I never noticed it until the next morning, and my mother didn't see it until the next winter, and by then she thought the frost on it. I just about flew across to that window and heaved it up. It grated and rumbled against the frame, the way they only seem to do when you're a kid and you want to get out after midnight. Lewis laughed, even though he could not remember ever having wanted to get out of the house at some dark hour when he was a boy of 10. Still, if he had wanted to, he was sure that windows which had never creaked in the daytime would creak then. I figured my folks must have thought burglars were trying to break in, but when my heart quieted down, I could hear my dad still sawing wood in the bedroom on the first floor. I looked out, and there was Danny B., standing in our driveway and looking up, swaying like there was a high wind when there wasn't so much as a puff of breeze. I don't think he ever would have come, Lewis, except that he'd gotten to that stage of drunkenness where you're as wide awake as an owl with diarrhea, and you just don't give a care about anything. And he sort of yells up at me, only I guess he thought he was whispering, "You coming down, boy, or am I coming up to get you?" "Shh," I says, scared to death now that my dad will wake up and give me the whopping of my young life. "What'd you say?" Stanny says, even louder than before. "If my parents had been around on the road side of this house, Lewis, I would have been a goner. But they had the bedroom that belongs to Norma and me now, with the river view."
"I bet you got down those stairs in one hell of a hurry," Lewis said. "Have you got another beer, Judd?" He was already two past his usual limit, but tonight that seemed okay. Tonight that seemed almost mandatory.
"I do, and you know where they're kept," Judd said and lit a fresh smoke.
He waited until Lewis was seated again.
"No, I wouldn't have dared to try the stairs. They went past my parents' bedroom. I went down the ivy trellis, hand over hand, just as quick as I could. I was some scared, I can tell you, but I think I was more scared of my dad just then than I was of going up to the pet cemetery with Stanny B."
He crushed out his smoke.
"We went up there, the two of us, and I guess Stanny B must have fallen down half a dozen times if he fell down once. He was really far gone, smelled like he'd fallen into a vat of corn. One time he damn near put a stick through his throat, but he had a pick and shovel with him. When we got to the pet cemetery, I kind of expected he'd sling me the pick and shovel and just pass out while I dug the hole. Instead, he seemed to sober up a little. He told me we was going on, up over the deadfall and deeper into the woods, where there was another burial place. I looked at Stanny, who was so drunk he could barely keep his feet, and I looked at that deadfall, and I said, 'You can't climb that, Stanny B., you'll break your neck.' And he said, 'I ain't gonna break my neck, me, and neither are you. I can walk, and you can lug your dog.' And he was right. He sailed up over that deadfall just as smooth as silk, never even looking down. And I lugged Spot all the way up there, although he must have weighed 35 pounds or so, and I only went about 90 myself. I want to tell you, though, Lewis, I was some sore and sprung the next day. How do you feel today?" Lewis didn't answer, only nodded. "We walked and we walked," Judd said. "It seemed to me we was going to walk forever. The woods were spookier in those days. More birds calling from the trees, and you didn't know what any of them was. Animals moving around out there. Deer, most likely. But back then there were moose, too, and bears and catamounts. I dragged Spot. After a while I started to get the funny idea that old Stanny B. was gone, and I was following an Indian. Following an Indian, and somewhere farther along he'd turn around, all grinning and black-eyed, his face streaked up with that stinking paint they made from bear fat, that he'd have a tomahawk made out of a wedge of slate and a hake of ashwood all tied together with rawhide, and he'd grab me by the back of the neck and whack off my hair, along with the top of my skull. Stanny wasn't staggering or falling anymore. He just walked straight and easy, with his head up, and that sort of helped to feed the idea. But when we got to the edge of the Little Guard Swamp and he turned around to talk to me, I seen it was Stanny all right. And the reason he wasn't staggering or falling anymore was because he was scared. Scared himself sober, he did. He told me the same things I told you last night, about the loons and the St. Elmo's fire, and how I wasn't to take notice of anything I saw or heard. Most of all, he said, don't speak to anything, if it should speak to you. Then we started across the swamp, and I did see something. I ain't gonna tell you what, only that I've been up there maybe 5 times since that time when I was 10, and I've never seen anything like it again. Nor will I, Lewis, because my trip to the Micmac burial place last night was my last trip. I'm not sitting here believing all this, am I? Lewis asked himself almost conversationally. The 3 beers helped him to sound conversational, at least to his own mind's ear. I am not sitting here believing this story of old Frenchmen and Indian burying grounds, and something called the Wendigo and pets that come back to life, am I? For Christ's sake, the cat was stunned, that's all. A car hit it and stunned it. No big deal. This is a senile old man's maunderings. Except that it wasn't. And Lewis knew it wasn't. And 3 beers wasn't going to cure that knowing, and 33 beers wouldn't. Church had been dead. That was one thing. He was alive now, and that was another. There was something fundamentally different, fundamentally wrong about him, and that was a third. Something had happened. Judd had repaid what he saw as a favor. But the medicine available at the Micmac burying ground was perhaps not such good medicine, and Lewis now saw something in Judd's eyes that told him the old man knew it. Lewis thought of what he had seen, or thought he had seen, in Judd's eyes the night before. That capering, gleeful thing. He remembered thinking that Judd's decision to take Lewis and Ellie's cat on that particular night journey had not entirely been Judd's own. If not his, then whose? His mind asked. And because he had no answer, Lewis swept the uncomfortable question away. I buried Spot and built the cairn, Judd went on flatly. And by the time I was done, Stanny B. was fast asleep. I had to shake the hell out of him to get him going again, but by the time we got down those 44 stairs... 45, Lewis murmured. Judd nodded. Yeah, that's right, ain't it? 45. By the time we got down those 45 stairs, he was walking as steady as if he was sober again. We went back through the swamp and the woods and over the deadfall, and finally we crossed the rud, and we was at my house again. It seemed to me like 10 hours must have gone past, but it was still full dark. What happens now? I asked Annie B. Now you wait and see what may happen, Stanny says, and off he walks, staggering and lurching again. I imagine he slept out in back of the livery that night, and as things turned out, my dog Spot outlived Stanny B. by 2 years. His liver went bad and poisoned him, and 2 little kids found him in the rud on July 4th, 1912, stiff as a poker. But me that night, I just climbed back up the ivy and got into bed and fell asleep almost as soon as my head touched the pillow. Next morning I didn't get up until almost 9 o'clock, and then my mother was calling me. My dad worked on the railroad and he would have been gone since 6, Judd paused, thinking. My mother wasn't just calling me, Lewis. She was screaming for me. Judd went to the fridge, got himself a Miller's, and opened it on the drawer handle below the bread box and toaster. His face looked yellow in the overhead light, the color of nicotine. He drained half his beer, uttered a belch like a gunshot, and then glanced down the hall towards the room where Norma slept. He looked back at Lewis. This is hard for me to talk about, he said. I have turned it over in my mind, years and years. But I've never told anyone about it. Others knew what had happened, but they never talked to me about it. the way it is about sex, I guess. I'm telling you, Lewis, because you've got a different kind of pet now. Not necessarily a dangerous one, but different. Do you find that's true?
Lewis thought of Church jumping awkwardly off the toilet seat, his haunches thudding against the side of the tub. He thought of those muddy eyes that were almost but not quite stupid, staring into his own. At last he nodded.
When I got downstairs, my mother was backed into a corner in the pantry, between our icebox and one of the counters. There was a bunch of white stuff on the floor, curtains she'd been meaning to hang.
Standing in the doorway of the pantry was Spot, my dog. There was dirt all over him, and mud splashed clear up his legs. The fur on his belly was filthy, all knotted and snarled. He was just standing there, not growling or nothing, just standing there. But it was pretty clear that he had backed her into a corner, whether he meant to or not. She was in terror, Lewis. I don't know how you felt about your parents, but I know how I felt about mine. I loved them both dearly. Knowing I'd done something to put my own mother in terror took away any joy I might have felt when I saw Spot standing there. I didn't even seem to feel surprised that he was there.
I know the feeling, Lewis said. When I saw Church this morning, it seemed like something that was...
He paused a moment. Perfectly natural. Those were the words that came immediately to mind, but they were not the right words. Like something that was meant.
Yes, Judd said. He lit a fresh cigarette. His hands were shaking the smallest bit.
And my mother seen me there, still in my underwear, and she screamed at me.
Feed your dog, Judd. Your dog needs to be fed. Get him out of here before he messes the curtains.
So I found him some scraps and called him. And at first he didn't come. At first it was like he didn't know his own name. And I almost thought, well, this ain't Spot at all. It's some stray that looks like Spot. That's all.
Yes,
Lewis exclaimed.
Judd nodded. But the second or third time I called him, he came. He sort of jerked toward me, and when I let him out onto the porch, damned if he didn't run into the side of the door and just about fall over. He ate the scraps, though, just wolfed them down. By then I was over my first fright and was starting to get an idea of what had happened. I got on my knees and hugged him. I was so glad to see him. Then he licked my face, and...
Judge shuddered and finished his beer.
Lewis, his tongue was cold. Being licked by Spot was like getting rubbed up the side of your face with a dead carp. For a moment neither of them spoke. Then Lewis said, "Go on." He ate, and when he was done, I got an old tub we kept for him out under the back porch, and I gave him a bath. Spot always hated to have a bath. Usually it took both me and my dad to do it. And we'd end up with our shirts off and our pants soaked, and my dad cussing and Spot looking sort of ashamed, the way dogs do. And more likely than not, he'd roll around in the dirt right after, and then go over by my mother's clothesline to shake off and put dirt all over the sheet she had hung, and she'd scream at both of us that she was going to shoot that dog for a stranger before she got much older.
But that day, Spot just sat in the tub and let me wash him. He never moved at all. I didn't like it. It was like washing meat. I got an old piece of towel after I gave him his bath and dried him all off. I could see the places where the barbed wire had hooked him. There was no fur in any of those places, and the flesh looked dimpled in. It is the way an old wound looks after it's been healed 5 years and more. Lewis nodded. In his line of work, he had seen such things from time to time. The wound never seemed to fill in completely, and that made him think of graves and his days as an undertaker's apprentice, and how there was never enough dirt to fill them in again. Then I saw his head. There was another one of those dimples there, but the fur had grown back white in a little circle.
It was near his ear. "Where your father shot him," Lewis said. Judd nodded. "Shooting a man or an animal in the head isn't as surefire as it sounds, Judd. There would be suicides in vegetable wards or even walking around right as rain who didn't know that a bullet can strike the skull plate and travel right around it in a semicircle, exiting the other side without ever penetrating the brain. I personally saw one case where a fellow shot himself above the right ear and died because the bullet went around his head and tore open his jugular vein on the other side of his head. That bullet path looked like a county road map." Judd smiled and nodded.
"I remember reading something like that in one of Norma's newspapers, The Star, or The Enquirer, one of those. But if my pop said Spot was gone, Lewis, he was gone."
"All right," Lewis said. "If you say that's how it was, that's how it was."
"Was your daughter's cat gone?"
"I sure thought it was," Lewis said.
"You gotta do better than that. You're a doctor."
"You make it sound like you gotta do better than that, Lewis. You're God."
"I'm not God. It was dark." "Sure, it was dark. And his head swiveled on his neck like it was full of ball bearings. And when you moved him, he pulled out of the frost, Lewis. Sounded like a piece of sticky tape coming off a letter. Live things don't do that. You only stop melting the frost under where you're laying when you're dead."
In the other room, the clock struck 10:30. "What did your father say when he came home and saw the dog?" Lewis asked.
"I was out in the driveway shooting marbles in the dirt, more or less waiting for him. I felt like I always felt when I'd done something wrong and knew I was probably gonna get a spanking. He come in through the gateposts about 8 o'clock, wearing his bib overalls and his pillow-tick cap. You ever see one of those?"
Lewis nodded, then stifled a yawn with the back of his hand.
"Yeah, getting late," Judd said. "Gotta finish this up."
"It's not that late," Lewis said. "I'm just a few beers ahead of my usual pace." "Go on, Judd. Take your time. I want to hear this."
"My dad had an old lard tin he kept his dinner in," Judd said. "And he come in through the gate swinging it, empty, by the handle, you know, whistling something. It was getting dark, but he seen me there in the gloom, and he says, 'Hi there, Judkins,' like he would do, and then, 'Where's your—'" He got that far, and then here comes Spot out of the dark, not running like he usually did, ready to jump all over him, he was so glad to see him, but just walking, wagging his tail, and my dad dropped that lard bucket and stepped back. I don't know but what he would have turned tail and run, except his back hit the picket fence, and then he just stood there, looking at the dog. And when Spot did jump up, Dad just caught his paws and held them, like you might hold a lady's hand you was getting ready to dance with. He looked at the dog for a long time, and then he looked at me, and he said, 'He needs a bath, Judd. He stinks of the ground you buried him in.' And then he went in the house."
"What did you do?" Lewis asked.
"Gave him another bath. He just sat there in the tub and took it again, and when I went in the house, my mother had gone to bed, even though it wasn't even 9 o'clock. My dad said, 'We got to talk, Judkins,' and I sat down across from him, and he talked to me like a man for the first time in my life, with the smell of the honeysuckle coming across the road from what's your house now, and the smell of the wild roses from our own house."
Judd Crandall sighed.
"I had always thought it would be good to have him talk to me that way, but it wasn't. It wasn't a bit good. All this tonight, Lewis, it's like when you look into a mirror that's been set up right across from another mirror, and you can see yourself going down a whole hall of mirrors. How many times has this story been passed along, I wonder? A story that's just the same except for the names. And that's like the sex thing, too, isn't it?"
"Your dad knew all about it."
"Yeah. Who took you up there, Judd?" he asked me. And I told him. He just nodded like it was what he would have expected. I guess it probably was, although I found out later that there were 6 or 8 people in Ludlow at that time that could have taken me up there. I guess he knew that Stanny B was the only one crazy enough to have actually done it.
Did you ask him why he didn't take you, Judd?
I did, Judd said. Somewhere during that long talk I did ask him that, and he said it was a bad place, by and large, and it didn't often do anything good for people who had lost their animals or for the animals themselves. He asked me if I liked Spot the way he was. And do you know, Lewis, I had the hardest time answering that. And it's important that I tell you my feelings on that, because sooner or later you're going to ask me why I led you up there with your daughter's cat if it was a bad thing to do. Isn't that so?
Lewis nodded. What was Ellie going to think about church when she got back? That had been much on his mind while he and Steve Masterton had been playing racquetball that afternoon.
Maybe I did it because kids need to know that sometimes dead is better, Judd said with some difficulty. That's something your Ellie don't know, and I got a feeling that maybe she don't know because your wife don't know. Now you go ahead and tell me if I'm wrong, and we'll leave it.
Lewis opened his mouth and then closed it again. Judd went on, now speaking very slowly, appearing to move from word to word, as they had moved from hummock to hummock in Little God's Swamp the night before.
I've seen it happen over the years, he said. I guess I told you that Lester Morgan buried his prize bull up there. Black Angus named Hanratty. Ain't that a silly name for a bull? Died of some sort of ulcer inside, and Lester dragged him all the way up there on a sledge. How he did it, how he got over the deadfall there, I don't know. But it said that what you want to do, you can. And at least as far as that burying ground goes, I'd say it's true. Well, Hanratty came back, but Lester shot him dead 2 weeks later. That bull turned mean, really mean. But he's the only animal I have ever heard of that did. Most of them just seem a little stupid, a little slow, a little dead. Yeah, Judd said, a little dead, like they had been somewhere and came back, but not all the way. Now, your daughter isn't gonna know that, Lewis. Not that a cat was hit by a car and killed and came back. So you could say you can't teach a child a lesson unless the child knows there's a lesson to be learned. Except sometimes you can, Lewis said, more to himself than to Judd.
Yes, Judd agreed. Sometimes you can. Maybe she'll learn something about what death really is, which is where the pain stops and the good memories begin. Not the end of life, but the end of pain. You don't tell her those things. She will figure them out on her own. And if she's anything like me, she'll go on loving her pet. It won't turn vicious, a bite, or anything like that. She'll go on loving it, but she'll draw her own conclusions. And she'll breathe a sigh of relief when it finally dies.
That's why you took me up there, Lewis said. He felt better now. He had an explanation. It was diffuse. It relied more upon the logic of the nerve endings than the logic of the rational mind. But under the circumstances, he found he could accept that. And it meant he could forget the expression he thought he had seen on Judd's face briefly last night. That dark, capering glee.
Okay. That's abruptly, almost shockingly, Judd covered his face with both hands. For one moment, Lewis thought he had been struck by a sudden pain, and he half rose, concerned, until he saw the convulsive heave of the chest and realized that the old man was struggling not to cry.
That's why, but it ain't why, he said in a strangled, choked voice. I did it for the same reason Stanny B did it, and for the same reason Lester Morgan did it. Lester took Linda Levesque up there after her dog got run over in the road. He took her up there,
even though he had to put his goddamn bull out of its misery for chasing kids through its pasture like it was mad. He did it anyway. He did it anyway, Lewis. Judd almost moaned. And what the Christ?